I've rearranged the flat, the living room in the main.
Oh my God, the whole thing, furniture.
Yeah, we've had...
That's a big deal, man.
We've had subsidence for... It's been a long time. You know, they observe, they see movement. It's very dreary. The day's finally come. Supposedly, there's no movement.
So there's no subsidence?
No, that's what we'll tell the people who are going to buy the flat. So they send someone round to fix the cracks in the living room and whatnot, and paint and plaster.
Yeah.
And lovely guy. It meant I got to talk to a tradesman.
Oh.
And pretend like I could commune. I started talking a bit more like this. And going, right, mate.
Well, you've been doing improv, haven't you? So did that help you when you were trying to commune with the tradesman?
I think I've always been very, very good at it. I've always just, you just sort of kind of go, what a cuppa, mate. Should we bang on magic?
Yeah.
Do you want to put on magic? Bicky? Do you want a bicky? But anyway, everything within the living room got moved into the middle of the living room.
Yeah.
And... the two sofas, a longer one and a smaller one. I won't go into all of the bits. It all got moved in.
Yeah.
There was all this space. We have this big train. It's called a train. We call it the train table because my youngest plays with trains on it. It's very large and it's taken up the entirety of the middle space of the living room. So that's got to come out. That's come out. All this, a lot of furniture coming out of the living room.
Yeah.
Fix, paint. He's finished a day early.
Wow.
So...
Are you worried he hasn't done the job properly?
No, he's done the job properly.
Yeah?
Yeah?
You had a rapport, so you know that.
So now... But now I've got a blank slate.
Uh-huh.
I've got a blank slate of a living room. I can reorganise my life. And I've done it.
And what's it like now? What's different?
The whole middle bit of the room where this train table was.
Yeah.
That's now firmly against the wall.
Oh.
My sofa, the kind of pull-out bed sofa for when the in-laws come round.
Yeah.
Is basically right next to my telly. The telly was so far away from a sofa. It's angles because it's in the bay. There's a kind of angled bay... Where the rotting windows are.
Hang on, are you diagonally following a bay window?
Yeah.
Oh.
And it's thing is, my wife, I've done this without my wife's consent.
I don't like the sound of it.
I've done this without my wife's consent.
Can you actually send me a photo now? Do you mind? So I can see. I think it's very important that I see this so that I can judge on behalf of the listeners. Because what we're hearing, I don't like it. Am I allowed to react to this photo?
Yeah, go on. What's the problem?
It's all wrong. You've done it wrong.
Listen.
I actually hate it. This isn't even a bit for the podcast. So you've done it wrong. Your wife's going to hate it.
I don't care because this is the first time she's... And the reason why I'm also talking so quietly is because she's left me.
Yeah. Wait. This time, for real?
Yeah. Not for real this time.
Okay.
I love the idea that one day I'm going to say that on this podcast and it will be for real. No, she's left me. She's a yoga teacher.
Yeah, you don't have a big living room though. Telling people about your living room.
No, she's not my living room. It's her job.
No, she's a yoga teacher, but yeah, she doesn't. You don't have a big living room. You know.
No. okay.
It's an important distinction to make because sometimes when you tell people you're a yoga teacher, the immediate assumption is you do have a big living room.
Right. So,
and to be honest, you did have a big living room, but now with what you've done, it's.
So she sometimes twice a year, three times a year, she'll do a retreat where she will go away. She will teach a retreat. Sometimes she goes on it to just have fun, but this time this is work.
Yeah.
Okay. She's on a work retreat.
Yeah.
She's left me, and she's not going to be back. It's Thursday evening. She's not going to be back until Sunday afternoon. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine
so much time to rearrange the living room back to where it was when she left? That's really good news.
No time. Well, no, because also she left on the day that the man left.
Right.
The man left. I've got a blank slate and I've recreated. I've just created a new vibe. And I love it. I'm so close to my telly. Yeah. The desk.
You are an edgy guy. So maybe it makes sense. You would want to be in a space that has lots of edges.
That is the drawback. Okay, visually, I'll accept. That's what I've done. And the guy, as he was leaving,
yeah,
he was sort of offering me all kinds of help to kind of move the sofas back and stuff. I said, oh, no, don't worry about it. I'm going to use this opportunity to kind of refigure the whole living room. And he sort of nodded. It wasn't, again, not that interested. And
I said, didn't care.
And I said, yeah, my wife's going away and I'm just going to completely redo it. You know, I'm going to reimagine our lives. And he laughed and he kind of looked at me and he went, and it was then amazing because we then managed to launch into a lovely, lovely little bit of sexist banter.
Yeah.
Of like, do you really want to do that, mate? And he said, oh, ooh, that's bad. When you take their power away from them, when you take their power away from them. And I thought, yeah, that is when they get annoyed. That is when wives get annoyed. When you take my wife's power is in the domain of her power, is the order of my living room.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take that power away from
her. Yeah, you've taken it back. Yeah, man. It's amazing how sexist you can get it. Not just you. How sexist one can get in a sexist conversation. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I do it all the time. Like when, you know, you get in a taxi or you know, in a, I don't know, butcher's shop.
Football game.
Butcher's shop. And I'm joking, of course. And, you know, someone says, all they've got to do is go, ooh, ball and chain. And then I go, yeah, ball and chain, you know. But my wife's not a ball and chain.
As soon as anyone says ball and chain, I'm going, ball and chain.
Yeah.
Love of my life, ball and chain.
Did I mention to you, by the way, that surprisingly 51% of our audience are female?
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host. And Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost.
Hello, it's the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond, and joining me as ever, I'm going to introduce him before I even tell you what the show's about. Oh. It's the old Lakey Bucket Boy. He's Mr. Joe Devine.
Hello. Are you coming to me from Blackpool Dance Hall? It sounds very... you know?
Well, as you know, I've rearranged my living room and now I am a new man. I'm a Gary Newman. And
sure,
this is the show in which we chat about, me and Joe, that is,
Gary Newman.
The movies or films. It can be films that we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. I'm just going to go straight into it. On today's episode, we're doing the 2010 flick, The King's Speech, starring Colin Firth. He's your headline. Never mind who directed it.
Big time.
Tom Hooper.
Yeah.
It also stars, of course, Geoffrey Rush, who... There's a slight cloud over Geoffrey Rush. We probably won't talk about old Jeff. Also stars Helena Bonham Carter,
uh-huh,
who's delightful in this flick. Guy Pearce pops up, Timothy Spall, Michael Gambon, and Jennifer Ely. Oh, and also, come on, got to mention Derek Jacobi. Very big actors for some minor parts there.
Sure. But they all want to be associated with the royals, don't they? They all want to get royal adjacent, I think.
I think they all just, you know, want to get paid. They're all jobbing actors.
Sure,
and these
sure,
are
sure,
all
sure, sure.
Fairly decent parts.
Okay, well... Way to take the romance out of it, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, sorry, you're right. Okay, I should have just said yes and you're right, Joe.
There was a lot of fun to be had with royal adjacency, but no, No, it's fine. They just want to get paid. They just want to get paid.
Okay, let's come back. We'll get
people
back.
Are you only motivated by economics in your capitalist utopia, aren't they? Not about royal adjacency or any such silliness.
Where do you get off throwing off a term like royal adjacency?
Royal adjacency.
Yeah, where's that come from, and what do you think you're going to get out?
It comes from the fact that I believe, and listen. I am a Republican. I'm not really. I actively don't care. But I don't love the royal family or anything. But I still believe that despite my ancestors being Irish and me having a sort of general distaste for their position, that I am more proximal to the royals than you are. Do you know what I mean? Like in the set, you know, like what's that King Ralph movie? You know, the notion that if all of the people in front of you in the line to be the next king died, you could be the king. I reckon I'm closer in line than you, even if we're both thousands and thousands away.
Right. I mean, that's the sort of thing Danny Dyer would say.
Is it?
Like you and Danny Dyer. Yeah, Danny Dyer did a whole Who Do You Think You Are episode, and he was like, what do you fucking mean? What? I'm like 10th in line after King Henry VIII. Well, you're having a laugh, ain't you? And everyone went, you're like, oh, isn't that delightful? Oh, isn't that delightful? Even the most humblest of commonest of peasants could possibly be connected to the aristocracy.
Yeah, well, they did a lot of fucking. I think that's the thing, isn't it? They really popped their bits around in the olden days. So there's plenty of lineage to go about.
Yeah, but you know, fine. You be closer. You be closer to the royals.
I don't want to be closer. I just think I am. It's not a case of desire. It's just a case of likelihood. You know, who'd make a better royal? Would it be me or you?
Well, you're more of a cunt. So you.
But you look better in purple, you know? So it's hard to know, isn't it? It's hard to know.
I've got a higher hairline. Yeah. So maybe
you.
Me.
Yeah. You look more like the products of incest than I do.
I look more like a potato. So probably me.
Yeah. I look more like I've eaten all of the food in the royal kitchen. So probably me.
You look like your fingers are made out of sausage meat.
Yeah.
So probably you.
You actually look more like a skeletal German composer. So probably you. You live in a house big enough to have subsidence potentially. So probably you. Yeah.
So to the letterbox.
Here in my car. I feel safest of all. Do you know the lyrics to the song? I can lock all my doors. It's the only way to live in cars. Yeah.
Try to learn that to Princess Diana. To the Letterboxd. This is directed by Tom Hooper, Timothy Hooper, to call him by his full name.
Yeah.
It is 118 mins. I would suggest that's 8 mins too long.
Okay.
You could shave 8 mins off this flick. 110 mins.
Maybe you could, but I couldn't tell you what 8 mins.
Find your voice.
Oh.
The King's Speech tells the story of the man who became King George the VI. That's me knowing Roman numerals there, because it says VI.
Oh, well done.
The father of Queen Elizabeth II. Again, Roman numerals.
Yeah, that one's easier though.
Yeah, no.
More of a tally than a Roman numeral. I know technically they are Roman numerals, but Roman numerals, they started out tallying, didn't they?
They did.
And then they were like, we've got to sort of add up. And instead of coming up with a new system like numbers, they did a hybrid tallying system where they started to like, see the one line we've got to represent one. Why don't we put one diagonally and then get another one diagonally and have their bums touch? And then that will be a 5 because the bums are touching. And what about if we get them again and we can have them cross over like they're sort of scissoring, and that can be a 10 because they're scissoring, you know? It's like, come on, Romans. What, Rome? Yeah, Rome. You could have built Rome in a fucking day if that's all you were doing. Jesus Christ. Come up with some numbers for crying out loud.
After his brother, that's Colin Firth, after his brother abdicates, George, Bertie, reluctantly assumes the throne, Plagued by a dreaded stutter and considered unfit to be king, Bertie engages the help of an unorthodox... This is completely fucked out of order.
Yeah.
Plagued by a dreaded stutter and considered unfit to be king, Bertie engages the help of an unorthodox speech therapist named Lionel Logue. Through a set of unexpected techniques and as a result of an unlikely friendship, Bertie is able to find his voice and boldly lead the country into war.
Can I read the IMDb to you?
Do, because this is like so out of fucking order.
Yeah.
Like it is literally out of order, and it is also like in a like Danny Dyer, that's fucking out of order. It is too long. It's fucking wrong.
It's the whole story.
And so Letterboxd.
Look, here's how premium website outlet does it. Okay. The story of King George VI, his unexpected ascension to the throne of the British Empire in 1936, and the speech therapist who helped the unsure monarch overcome his stammer.
Wow.
That's it.
Wow, lovely. It alludes to things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It doesn't tell you too much. It just tells you just enough. Colin Firth plays the would-be king in question, a.k.a. Bertie, and Lionel Logue, the speech therapist, is played by Geoffrey Rush. Helena Bonham Carter plays Bertie's wife, who's the queen mother. Mm-hmm. Or the Queen Mother's mother.
No, the Queen Mother.
The Queen Mother.
Yeah. Their child, the eldest child, becomes the Queen who just died.
Right.
That's Elizabeth the Queen.
That's Elizabeth the Queen. Now, let's get into the film. Do you remember when this film came out?
Yes, I do.
Because I remember when this film came out. Did you get to see it clean? Or did you...
No.
Now ask me it back. You asked me that back. I'll tell you what. Adam, no, I didn't. You Adam, don't need to ask me.
No, Adam. Did you get to see this film? Do you remember when this film came out?
Yeah, no, I do remember when this came out. Yeah.
And did you get to see it clean?
No, mate, I didn't get to see this clean either.
How interesting. Why was that?
I think for the same reason you did. I don't know if it was possible to see this film clean.
No, we were all very dirty. Pretty quickly, as soon as the film came out, everyone was covered in filth.
It came out and it seemed like it was an instant critical fave and awards fave.
Yes.
And I'm going to...
It is worth saying that the film was released in January, both in the UK and in the US, which, for people who follow awards season, will know is about a month or two out of the Oscars ceremony. So in more recent years... Often, big studios that have films that are might be considered favourites for awards, or that the studio might be spending a lot of money on in order to campaign for awards, will release closer to the award ceremonies in order to kind of be fresh in the mind of voters. And January is prime for a film that might be seeking to do that. So it's hard to watch those clean a lot of the time. You're very dirty by the time you're watching them. It's also worth saying that films like that release in January... unlike films that release around the rest of the year where they might leave the hype campaign for afterwards, the hype campaign tends to predate the release of the film. So by the time you can even go and see it, even if you go on opening weekend, you've already probably heard a lot about it being awards baity if you're paying any attention at all.
It's not just that. It's not just an awards time. It's not just an awards slot. It was released by the Weinsteins.
Yes.
Aside from what's gone on now, back in the day, let's talk historically, they were just notorious for clinical, horrible, cynical Oscar campaigns. They did it for Shakespeare in Love.
Lion, I remember, which is a shame because Lion, again, it's a fabulous film with Dev Patel. One, again, that you need to watch divorced from that campaigning period.
And that, I mean, that's the thing is Oscar-wise, Lion didn't even do that well.
And yet it was still tainted because they really tried.
Right. And so that's the thing, like a lot of films just start to get tainted by the actual campaign around the film. Billy Elliot was another one. I mean, the main one is Shakespeare in Love because that film is so soft. And it won so many Oscars.
In fact, Shakespeare in Love is such a big story with Weinstein because it won Best Oscar in 1999, in the year that Saving Private Ryan was released. And Saving Private Ryan was you know, considered the front runner when it was released. It's obviously a much better film. But Weinstein kind of took campaigning for the Oscars to the next level that year, so to speak. I'm reading now from a BBC article from a couple of years ago, which, you know, talks about the fact that there were a lot of legitimate reasons why people liked Shakespeare in Love. Quote, things reached a head when word spread that Weinstein was secretly bad-mouthing Saving Private Ryan to journalists, trying to plant the idea that the film tailed off after the first 25 minutes. This kind of negative campaigning was a huge no-no in the Oscars race. Spielberg refused to stoop to Weinstein's level, but DreamWorks stepped up their campaigning as well, running lots more ads in the trade press. And there's all these amazing articles I've read before about the kind of dark arts of Oscar campaigning and how, like, the studios have every year start to take it more and more and more seriously, and how it becomes more and more involved and weird and bizarre and mean and, like, totally unartistic, you know. But Weinstein seemed to have a bit of a knack for it.
Yeah, and obviously that's not the worst thing he did.
No.
Although I would also argue that Saving Private Ryan does actually taper off after the first 25 minutes.
Well, it's hard to not taper off after the storming of Normandy Beach, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, yeah.
One could argue that the Second World War tapered off after the storming of Normandy Beach. I mean, one wouldn't want to argue that because one would feel very ashamed to even make any kind of argument approaching that. And one would wish that one had never said anything like that, but one would have to contend with the fact that one did say it.
One, you've become very royal. You are actually quite royal.
Well, I mean, the royal podcast episode, one must acquaint oneself well when speaking with the other royals.
You could catch me out on Saving Private Ryan because
are you serious?
Never rewatched it. I saw it in the cinema.
And here you are, talking about how it tapered off after 25 minutes.
Well, yeah, in my memory. I'm not Leaky Bucket Boy. I remember watching it, and I remember it fucking tapering off after 25 minutes. Yeah?
Yeah, that's a very good argument.
But yeah, the Weinstein Company became experts at just knowing when to release, and it becomes about a marketing exercise as opposed to something... Yeah, like, what's the best film? And so, yeah, come 2010, a film like King's Speech comes out in England. Me and Joe, we're hardened, aren't we? We're hardened to this kind of shit.
Absolutely, yeah.
We smell blood in the water.
We're cynical as fuck.
And it's about the fucking royals.
Yeah.
Joe's a Republican. Yeah, I remember just immediately hackles were raised at the idea that it's like, oh, here we go. Here we go. Oh, it's already been anointed. It's about royals. It's about a guy who's got a stutter. He's overcoming something. It, you know, you're just like, ugh.
Yeah.
And then I saw it and, you know, because the walls are up, I just thought, fuck this.
Yeah.
This isn't that good. How dare this be in the Oscar conversation?
I mean, I'm ashamed to say, Adam, that those things did affect me. A combination of the weird Oscar baiting campaigning and the fact that it was about the royals and, you know, I was in my 20s. I hated it. I watched it in the cinema and I thought, what is this piece of shit? You know, when it won at the Oscar, I'm like, this is, you know, what a shame for art and cinema everywhere. And I never watched it again. I kind of stored it away in my memory. I even, when I said it to you on last week's episode, I didn't really want to watch it. And then I watched, I sat down, I split the film over two nights, not purposefully, but because I realised my wife hadn't seen it before and we'd started to watch it together. So we watched the first hour last night and I did not want to stop it. I was totally locked in and we got to the perfect midpoint of the film and we thought, okay, we'll pause it there and we'll pick it up again tonight. And I finished it about 2 hours ago and I'm left thinking... What a delightful film, A. B, what the fuck was I thinking, you know, 10, 15 years ago, whenever that was? And C, how did I not watch this in the intervening years? Because I think this is the kind of film that I probably could revisit on a decade-by-decade basis. I think the performances are all really... subtle, and they're not hammy in the way that I remember them. Nobody, you know, there are a couple of like fawning moments that I still don't like, but they're very swallowable, you know, inside of this kind of bigger, nicer pill of a movie. And I just think it's just a very pretty, nice, well-made, tight film that maybe you could cut 8 minutes from, but I really enjoyed it. And I don't know, I can't remember the last time I rewatched a film and my opinion has so drastically changed.
Whoa.
I love playing. This is the game I love playing with you. Guess the bit that almost got me going.
Well, of course I know the bit that got you going.
Open the door and got me going. Go on and guess it. I'll give you. Get it. Of course you know.
No, now I'm thinking there are maybe two or three.
No. Go with your gut. Go on. It's not Daddy. So here we go. Right. It's nothing to do with Gambon.
In which case, I know what it is.
Yeah.
Is it when he's telling the story to his kids?
Oh, mate. Absolutely nailed it.
The story about the penguin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and this is for anyone who hasn't seen it. What, go pause the podcast, watch the film. You might think it's insipid or trite. You'd be watching it wrong. This is textbook. If you didn't like a movie, you watched it at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing performance from Firth. You see a man. He wants to connect with his kids, try and tell them a story. He tries to say no, and they ask, they really want him, and he can't say no, and he battles
and he
his
picks
stammer.
To tell a story about a penguin.
The story he tells is also a lovely little microcosm fractal of the whole fucking film and who he is. Beautiful screenwriting, beautiful performance, and you are watching a man who doesn't want to look like a failure or who is trying to battle not being able to connect with his kids. I was just thinking about it. It's like, oh man, I'm just, it's...
But what about that would you connect with?
You are.
I mean, in your world, there's no hiding the failure, right? Like the kids know that. So is it, are you forlorning a time gone by? Was this something that happened to you in the past?
No. In all seriousness, I think it struck one of the biggest chords this year.
Wow.
Movie wise.
Good Lord.
I feel that moment, that scene, not the film. The film kind of starts to.
Sure. Don't worry about that. What about the scene?
Yeah. It really. I felt seen, you know, when you feel seen by a movie.
Yeah.
And I haven't felt seen by a movie for quite some time. It feels like months, feels like a while. So that was just, it's interesting you say sports, because I thought you're watching, as soon as I was watching this, I realised this is just a sports movie.
It's a sports friends movie.
A sports friends movie.
Mm.
Yeah, Rocky. It's Rocky, but with speech impediment.
Well, it's a lot less eggy than Whiplash, isn't it? You know, it's Whiplash if J.K. Simmons was really nice.
And as a result, I mean, the finale of Whiplash is you cannot take your eyes off. The finale of this is pretty great. It's a edit of Firth giving the speech. But it's nowhere near as electric as Miles Teller doing his final drum solo.
It's not, but the really impressive thing about it is that it's like a magician who tells you how the magic trick is done and then does the magic trick, and the magic trick is still good. You know, there's bits before where you're seeing all these little vocal techniques in order to get over hard letters that start at the beginning of words. So there's a fun bit in the actual speech where he struggles to say peoples. So the advice is to say our peoples, like use the A to lean into it and get it into it a bit more straightforwardly. And they also reveal that, you know, he said, oh, I'm going to be the slowest. There are going to be so many pauses in my speech. And he says, yeah, pauses are good. Like give the impression of solemnity. You know, they add drama to it. And when you listen to him give the speech, there are these long pauses, but with the added to the visuals and watching people completely hooked listening to it, you do feel the solemnity, you do feel the drama of it, even though you've already been told how the trick works. I thought that was really neat.
Yeah, it's fucking great writing.
Yeah, it's good writing.
And this won Best Oscar Screenplay, and now I don't fucking mind it at all that it won Best Screenplay. This is great because it beat A Forgot You Forgot, The Fighter.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And this is better than The Fighter.
Sure, sure.
By a long chalk. And it beat Inception. And it beat The Kids Are All Right. I don't mind that it beat those films. And I've, you know, who am I? Who am I? I'm a Sir Christopher Nolan guy. Oh, yeah, no, fuck. It also beats Another Year. I missed that. Mike Lee, which I've not seen. I don't mind that because I haven't seen it. I didn't like The Kids Are All Right when I saw it. Maybe I watched it at the wrong time.
Oh, you did, because I loved that film. I thought it was great.
Okay. Inception, screenplay, it's Elliot Page going, so what's Inception?
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, tell me what's going on? I wouldn't give Best Screenplay to Inception.
How does this bit work? What should the audience be feeling right now?
Like, I've mentioned Oscars now. It does very well at the Oscars.
Oh, it does mighty fine at the Oscars, doesn't it?
What other flicks are knocking around?
Well, in that year, Colin Firth wins actor in a leading role.
Who's he beat?
He beats Javier Bardem in Beautiful, Jeff Bridges, True Grit, Jesse Eisenberg, The Social Network, and James Franco for 127 hours. So
yeah,
probably an indisputable victor. There.
He's really good in this, so have it.
Helena Bonham Carter loses out in actress in a best supporting role. I don't know if you remember, best actress in a supporting role, I should say. I don't know if you remember when we talked about The Fighter, this was the year where there were two actress in a supporting role nominations from The Fighter. And the winner that year was Melissa Leo.
Right.
Amy Adams was also nominated. And then also Jackie Weaver for Animal Kingdom, never seen that. And Hayley Steinfeld for True Grit.
Yeah, that's all a toss-up. They're all very, very good.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom Hooper wins for Best Director. And he beats David O. Russell for The Fighter, Fincher for The Social Network, and Coens for True Grit. You see, True Grit is knocking around this whole thing, and I don't understand at all.
I've never seen it, but I mean, there were a few other like obvious ones as well where it lost out. It lost out to Inception in cinematography. It lost out in art direction and in costume design to Alice in Wonderland. Although this is the kind of film that in a year without something, you know, more dramatic would win these sorts of awards, because I think both the art direction and the costume design in sort of period set films like this are very good. I mean, Helena Bonham Carter's outfits in every scene she's in are brilliant. And I think I like it when a film is nominated or wins, which is a bit more low-key in those sorts of categories, like costume design particularly, because I think the way that they have dressed her specifically in the different settings in which she, you know, she plays a very formal character who is concerned with and talks a lot about the way in which things should be hierarchically and in terms of like social etiquette and the rest of it. She's always dressed very appropriately for whatever scene she's in, whatever context she's in. And even in the really casual scenes where she's dressed in a dressing gown or in homeware or whatever, I just think the people working on that have done a really nice job. It just feels really right. And I think that's quite a hard thing to do when you're dressing characters who are supposed to be royals, you know, and are based on real life people.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and also the production design of it, the studio where they do Lionel Logue's studio, it's supposed to be quite tatty, but it's also quite, it's almost like a painting. The kind of torn wallpaper back wall, it looks stunning. And I know that they will have made this for a tuppence, but yeah, of course Inception should win cinematography. Inception looks fucking gorgeous.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, it wins all the technical awards.
Yeah.
I guess maybe the only controversial one where you could argue the toss is it wins Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it beats Inception, and it beats Social Network, it beats Toy Story 3 and it beats Winter's Bone. And those flicks, you could
make a good argument for all of those films, I think.
Exactly. And then
including, you know, The King's Speech.
Yeah, and Harvey Weinstein has put his full fucking weight behind The King's Speech, and it's won. And it's soured what anyone would think of it, I think.
Yeah. How much do you know about old Firthy, Richmond?
The key thing I know about Firth is the thing that everyone knows about Firth. He was Mr. Darcy. He came out of a lake with a wet shirt.
Yes.
And everyone jizzed themselves.
Absolutely. Well, anyway, Pride and Prejudice, the BBC TV series, it comes out in 1995. I don't know enough about Colin Firth pre-Pride and Prejudice to know whether anything here is worth referencing or not. Do you?
Nothing is worth referencing. That puts him on the map.
That's him on map.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Well, following that, 1996, he's in The English Patient, which is a film with a whole huge British cast. And he's actually... He's terrific in that. He plays the husband of Kristen Scott, who is embroiled in a sort of romantic affair with Ralph Fiennes, and he's very likable in that film.
I've never
seen
it. Quite
a difficult, challenging role as well. It's very long, Adam. It's very long. It would take you a long time to get through it. I only watched it because I've always meant to, and it was about 2 hours and 50 minutes, and that was the exact length of a train I was getting. So I downloaded it and watched it on my phone, but... You know, flew by.
The key reason I've never watched it is because I used to watch the Adam and Joe show.
Right.
And they used to do puppet, like piss takes of famous films. This was back in the late 90s, like Titanic and stuff. You can find them on YouTube. And they did The English Patient. And they think they gave away the whole plot of the movie. And a lot of it was that there's a funny, like bouncing the characters together like they were having sex in a bath. I just thought, I think not only have I been told the plot, they should not have solved that. Anyway, what happens
They do
next?
Have sex in a bath in that film, but it's in the desert, you know? So pretty cool.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool.
You should watch it at some point. I think it would be considered a classic. And for many of the actors involved, it's, you know...
It's been totally forgotten. It's not in the canon at all.
I'm saying it would be considered a classic for many of the actors involved.
Yeah, but it's not considered a classic in the canon. I don't want to be a pedant.
But that's not what I'm saying, though, is it? But you are being a pedant, because what you're saying back to me is something I'm not saying to you.
I don't want to be a pedant, but... A classic? What do you mean? So according to the actors who were in it, they'd consider it a classic.
For them in their career. Yeah.
I mean, fucking Rowan Atkinson would consider Johnny English a classic. So
no, that's not what I'm saying.
What are you saying?
The year after that, okay, it's 1997.
I hate myself.
He's gone P&P, he's gone E&P, and now he's going to F&P, yeah? It is, of course. It's Fever Pitch, the adaptation of the Nick Hornby novel, the story of one man's love of Arsenal in 1989, and also starring alongside Ruth Gemmell, probably Gemmell, isn't it?
Gemmell?
I don't think I've ever seen Ruth Gemmell or Gemmell in anything else, but I do remember her well from Fever Pitch.
Because I remember the book.
Right, yeah.
But
because you're a book guy. Did you ever read it?
No, of course I read the book. Mm-hmm. But I remember like the idea that they made that into a film, a romantic comedy, slightly like, what? You know, I think that was the time where they were trying to turn Firth into a romantic lead.
Right, yeah.
An English romantic lead. And
sure.
It's not a good film,
right? It's an okay film, I think. It's fine. I mean, to be honest, we could probably do it on the show at some point. I think it's okay.
Yeah, no, I'd do it. I'd do Fever Pitch because, I mean, the book is more of a series of diary entries, if anything. There isn't no narrative connection to it. But it's a bit mad, isn't it? The idea that you would make a romantic comedy to think that you would then be able to sell this movie around the world, but you're going to
come on. It was Britpop. It was the 90s. Tony Blair was in the 10 Downing Street. You know, it was all happening. Away, everyone liked Oasis.
And just hang it on Arsenal winning the Magic title.
Winning the Magic title. There's a sort of deeply moving, as insofar as I remember it, many years ago, sort of sequence of Hillsborough in the film, obviously from the book as well, which Hillsborough disaster took place that year. I remember that more than the rest of the film, I would say. If we ever did come to do it, the box office game is ruined, because let me tell you, the box office figures they have listed on IMDb are that the gross worldwide was $3,000 and the opening weekend US and Canada was $2,000. So I think we'd have to find those elsewhere. Mm. But we could do that at some point. Anyway, probably not necessary. Bit of a misstep, potentially. 1998... the next year on, so really we're only 3 years on from that Pride and Prejudice, and he is in Shakespeare in Love, the film we were just talking about, scooping up all the Oscars that year.
And he's a kind of buffoonish character in that,
sure.
Recall.
Yeah, but he, again, even when Firth is a buffoon, he's still very likable and very desirable.
Yeah, no, sure. No, this is why I like him. He's not a ego guy. He's not like, oh, I'm not going to... You know, he's not going to go, I want to be Joseph Fiennes. I want to be banging Paltrow. He's like, yeah, sure. No, I'll play the prick.
I'll play the prick. Yeah.
And he plays
Get
the prick.
Get me in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, listen, his time would come, of course, because even though, as you say, in 1997, they were trying to turn him into some kind of English romantic leading man. In 2001, he was an English romantic leading man in Bridget Jones's Diary, which was a huge... enormous, gargantuan success. And also he was equal to Hugh Grant, equal billing in that with Hugh Grant, which is very impressive for Colin Firth.
He plays Mr. Darcy.
Yeah,
do you get it? Shall I explain it to you? that is the film, because those are the guys, like, are they yin and yang? You know, who's yin and who's yang? Firth, Grant. I think, do you know what? They're different coins and they're different sides of different currency. People think that they're the same, or they like might be in the same kind of, but I think they're in different wheelhouses. Yeah, scratch all that from the record. I think it's all.
You'll
bollocks.
Love this though, yeah. 2003, getting jiggy with Scarlett Johansson in The Girl with the Pearl Earring, and he's got long hair in that film. I've never seen it. I don't know anything about it. But the same year, the big one.
They're all big. You keep saying the big one.
No, this is the big one though.
Pearl necklace. Sorry, pearl earring.
No,
pearl earring. No, I was going to say pearl earring was going to be a big one. It's that classic
Polaring.
Big book, hefty cast,
yeah.
Name cast, period drama, and then just turns out to be kind of perfectly fine, perfectly dull, and doesn't do any business, and no one really cared about it.
Sure. Yeah.
Never seen it.
Yeah.
Not interested.
Never seen it. Not interested. Now, no. 2003 also, big one, Love Actually, in which he does have... one of the sort of more, and it's an ensemble, but one of the more sizable roles. Yeah. And here's where I want to say...
One of the worst ones.
Here's what I want to say about Colin, though, okay? Because as we've discussed, pre-1995, despite the fact that he was acting for 11 years, we have decided there's nothing worth mentioning, right? There's nothing of note. There might be, but we've decided there's nothing of note pre-1995. That's what launches him onto the scene. By 2003, which is a mere 8 years later, in Love Actually, not just his performance in that, but his whole aura by that point in time in the British psyche is as someone who has been part of the sort of entertainment establishment forever, right? Colin Firth is so synonymous with high-class British acting, movie acting, film acting, whatever. You know, think of a British actor, you think of Colin Firth, right? He's canon British actor. And it took him no time at all to be considered that by everyone in the country. To be considered on the level of a Hugh Grant, for example, right? That is such a short space of time for that to happen in.
It's because of the lake, mate. It's because he came out.
He came out of the lake.
And he had a wet shirt. He came out of a lake.
Because you watch that scene back now. Just to be for anyone listening who doesn't recall, that's a scene in the BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. That's Adam describing Colin Firth coming out of a lake with a wet shirt that he takes off. It's, you watch that after you've seen Casino Royale, and it's kind of like, it's a comedy show. He's not an unattractive man, of course, but it's funny to think that people were excited by that at the time.
Imagine how unfulfilled, you know,
the people of the UK were, sure.
Yeah. Sways of the UK were,
yeah.
To be, you know, to have
be so desirous.
Timbers, to be the, you know, to have that, like, floater, flutter their boats.
To lift, have their timbers shivers.
Timber their shivers, you know, to make them rise, yeah, at the idea, yeah, of that. Amazing. That's what it was in, back in the 90s.
That's what it was.
That's how dry it was. And all it took was a big fucking burly Firth to come out with a wet shirt. And suddenly it's like...
No, big time, big time.
Niagara.
Yeah. well there's no point reading out all of his films since, because they are so numerous. But, and what I will say is that, he's only ever been a few years away from either a hit or a film considered, you know, a critical success for Colin Firth. He shows no signs of slowing, I would say.
Sorry, what are you saying? He's either in a film that's a hit or could be a hit.
No, I'm saying he's either in a film... He's never too far from being in a film which is a hit or would be considered a critical success. He hasn't had sort of long periods in his career, like other actors that we've spoken about, where he's gone for years without something which wasn't either a commercial success or a critical success, you know.
Great.
I don't see a Firth wilderness in here.
No. But then, has he had that absolute humdinger of a, I've got to see that guy in that film again and again. That the performance is one for the ages.
Adam, I think it's, I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying if there is one, I think it's The King's Speech.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
And I think one of the reasons that it might not be considered that kind of performance is because it's a very subtle performance. I know he does a bit of shouting in it, and I know there's an actual stammer in the film, but everything is underplayed, and it's because that's the way that would be accurate to the character, right? So in many ways, the film, although it has elements that seem like they might shout and seem like they might be perfect Oscar bait, that they're really subtle, they're underplayed.
I think it's almost like he's too good an actor, yeah? Because
he's too good for an Oscar.
He's not a showy actor. He's not showing his working. Like Daniel Day-Lewis does.
Yeah, he's not big Daniel Day-Lewis level showy, you know. He's not the kind of guy that would come out of retirement just to star in his son's film.
Yeah, he's got integrity, not like Daniel Day-Lewis.
I support that, though. I actually think that's a great thing to do.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy. If I've stubbed my toe, and you've broken your leg, I care more about my stubbed toe.
Sure. But you aren't King George VI.
No. But also, King George VI sounds like he had a really shit life, whereby he was abused by his nanny.
Yeah.
When he was 2 years old.
Yeah, he had a bad life.
Yeah. No, he didn't have a bad life. He sounded like he was abused and had a stutter, and was made fun of.
A stammer. He had a very English stammer. A stutter is the sort of thing that a Royal American would have, Adam, and there's none of those.
You what? Really? You're being serious?
I think a stutter is the kind of Americanism of a stammer, which is the British... I think it's why they... I think, they're totally interchangeable these days. In the context of the film, the reason they say stammer is because that's what people in Britain would have said. I think stutter is quite an American term, but obviously people use them interchangeably now.
Well, I'm really glad you picked me up on that. That's the kind of... That's my bread and butter, and you've served me up my bread and butter.
Sure.
And I don't like it.
You wouldn't get bread and butter in America. I mean, you would, but it wouldn't actually be real bread or real butter. It would be a kind of horrible... genetically modified food that would be 10 times as big as your head and would be full of cocaine.
Like where the film does show its hand it like being the bowing and scraping, it, where it's got Timothy Spall playing Winston Churchill. Hello, somewhere I'm with Winston Churchill.
Did you know I had a stutter as well in my day, a stammer?
And I was also a man. Yeah. Well done, sir.
Do you find it weird that I'm this central to the film and I'm not actually the Prime Minister at this point, but no one knows who George Lloyd is?
Amazing. So it's like, okay, we as filmmakers love Winston Churchill. You can't make this movie without loving Winston Churchill.
He's short, he's round, he fucked the Germans down. Winston Churchill, hey, Winston Churchill.
It's Space Village Timothy Spall, and he's talking like this. Well done, sir. Well done, sir. We will fight them on the beaches. We will fight them on the carber.
Meanwhile, there's old Gary Oldman watching on, thinking, I'm gonna do this myself. I'm gonna do a marvelous job.
We're all gonna do marvelous jobs, smashing it as Churchill. So the film is compromised,
yeah,
in that regard.
I was gonna say before, when I was really heavily praising it, that the one thing that lets it down is the Churchill stuff, because I think it's also, I'm guessing, but I'm fairly certain it's also like factually inaccurate for them to place him so central to the story. They're doing it because he's a famous known character, not because he was around.
But imagine this is a fictional movie. It's a sports movie.
Yeah.
It's about a bloke who's got to fucking learn how to do a speech.
Yeah.
The stakes are zero.
Yeah.
And it does a very good job of amping the stakes up just high enough.
Sure.
Not too much.
No.
Because it's just a guy giving a speech.
Yeah, then it'd be pathetic. If it was too much, it'd be pathetic.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's just the right amount of stakes.
Yeah.
They're personal. They're mainly personal stakes. But then also, we are going to go to war.
But you start believing, don't you? You start believing that actually, maybe it does matter. Maybe the people of Britain really do need to hear what the king says, because he says, he does this clever thing, doesn't he, where he says, if I was really a king, I'd have the power to form a government or start a war, but I don't have that power. All I have the power to do is speak on behalf of all of the people. And I'm thinking, hold on, you can't bait and switch us like that, Colin. Come on, you were doing down your position. You were saying, you were acknowledging that your position is largely ceremonial. And although people do like to pretend that, by the way, this is a nice little aside here, I'm really showing my Republican hand, but people always say that, don't they? They say, the royal position's purely ceremonial. They do sign off every bill that passes through the House of Commons and the House of Lords, but they don't actually, you know, they're just signing whatever is recommended by the government. Not true, Adam. Did you know that between a year that I can't remember in the 21st century and another year that I can't remember in the 21st century, but over a 10-year period, let's just say for the sake of argument, it was 2010 to 2020, the Queen personally vetoed 11 bills that made it through both the Commons and the Lords, where not only did the elected Parliament say this should be a law, but the fucking random Lords that we've decided should be the next stop also said, yeah, cool, we'll make this a law. And then the Queen done said no. Hmm? Ceremonial my fucking ass, mate. They're all in that shit.
Yeah. What I do really like, though, the film, because it has to spread its stakes so far and wide and kind of just really, it's like, it, but not overstate it, there's a bit where they're all watching a speech of his.
Yeah.
At home with him first.
It's his coronation speech.
It's right towards the end, the kids and stuff. You haven't seen him give it, and it's them watching it back.
Well, it's not really a speech. He just says four things, right? He answers the questions. Right. Do you want to be king? Yeah.
Yes.
Would you do a good job as king? Yeah. Do you promise to be king really good? Yeah, I do. That, and that's basically it.
And then the reel plays on, and who should turn up but Mr. Adolf Hitler?
Ah, Herr Hitler.
This is where the film really starts to go, the power of speech. And Hitler's just kind of going, rada bada bada, me na me na ma ma ma, wada bada bebe, we, wadubu, gada gada, me na me me me. And he's like smashing it. And little Lizzie, little future Queen Lizzie goes, Papa,
Papa, what's he saying? Who is that man? What's he saying?
And he says, and Papa Bertie says, I don't know what he's saying, but he's saying it rather well. And you're like, kaboom.
Yeah, yeah, there
it's
you
important.
Go. The soul
speeches
of the movie.
Speeches are important.
Speeches are really important. Matter. Yeah.
And I like, you know, just little bits like that that
sure.
the film's doing.
That
just in case you're
into
in
thinking.
Doubt. Just
yeah.
in case you're in doubt, yeah. Hitler was a good speaker.
That's right. Yeah. And yeah. look what happened there.
Look
yeah.
what happened to Hitler.
If you weren't careful, you're lucky to have a king that isn't that good of a speaker, because if he was good, he could make you do bad things. That's what the implication
don't
is.
Don't have a stutter. Don't have a stammer.
Anyway, it's important not to delve too deeply into these sorts of things, because the problem is, you could make as good a film as you want, but when you start pulling at the wet tissue paper of the royals, it's going to get all everywhere. Do you know what I'm saying? It does. It just plain doesn't make sense. And I know we have, it's important for us to remember this, Adam. We're a global phenomenon. You know, we have listeners from all around the world listening, and many of those people will listen from countries that, oddly enough, aren't monarchies and don't understand what the fuck we're doing here. And listen, we feel the same, most people. Not
they all come over
people,
here to watch. Listen, they all come over
like
here to watch
it.
Buckingham Palace.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, we watch the Kardashians, right? Like, everyone knows it's a fucking car crash. It doesn't mean you have to agree with it to want to go and look at it.
No, I'm saying they love it.
If the Americans had a queen,
they love it.
I'd go and look at that queen. I would. I'd be like, let's go and have a look at this queen then.
I'm sure somewhere today will remark that Christmas is a time for children. It's an engaging truth, but only half the story. Perhaps it's truer to say that Christmas can speak to the child within us all. Adults, when weighed down with worries, sometimes fail to see the joy in simple things, where children do not. As the carol says, the hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight.
Do you want to play the box office game?
Oh, I would love to play the box office game.
I'm quite excited about this one because...
this is a tricky business.
It is tricky business. And I think it's not going to follow Papa Devine's 10x rule, is it? That's for damn sure. Now, let's begin with the estimated budget, please. What do you think a beautiful propaganda film like this costs to make?
It's a prestige, but it's a UK picture.
Sure.
Okay.
It's small. Our bread is smaller. It has cheaper drugs in it than cocaine.
So yes, it's got a heart cast. It's got a cast. It's a small flick.
Yeah. It's set based, most of it, you know.
Oh, so much set based.
It's about the performances.
Special effects.
Yeah.
But
they're not renting Old Trafford for crying out loud. They're renting Ellen Road, aren't they? So,
do you think when they were making this though, script, cast, there's a little like they're thinking this is going to be a big flick, right? Or do you think it's still a hedge?
I think it's a bit of a hedge, but I think that it's certainly got big flick potential. For sure. Like, for example, the way I would think about that is that at work, where I make YouTube videos, right, I generally have a pretty good grasp on how well any given topic is going to perform. But sometimes there are topics where my range of how well it could do is very wide, because either there are factors that I haven't been able to consider or that I'm not fully able to comprehend, or there's just some kind of special factor involved that could make something rocket. And you just got off saying it yourself, right? You just were getting off saying it yourself. The whole rest of the world was obsessed with the English Queen, you know? So even though this is a British film, small film, British actors, whatever, it is about a topic that is of great interest to the rest of the world. And in that sense, it has the potential to run, doesn't it? But if you can hedge, why not hedge?
Why would you sign off on a YouTube video that you know wasn't going to do well?
Because it might be important journalistically, you know.
Good answer. So I reckon they spent $12 million on this.
You're very, very close. You're very close. It was $15 million was the estimated budget for this film. And I think, you know, good.
Yeah.
Good amount of money to spend.
Good amount of money.
On this film. Now.
Are the Yanks turning out for this flick?
What's interesting is that, do you remember at the beginning of the episode, I said that it was released in January?
Yeah.
The opening weekend US and Canada date given here is actually November the 28th. 2010.
So it was in November.
It was in November.
A longer, that makes more sense for the States.
It's weird that it was like released a month and a couple of weeks ahead in the States than it was in the UK, isn't it?
No, because that's the people who vote for the Oscars are American.
Huh.
That's exactly why they did it. That's for the Weinsteins.
Right.
They need to get it out into theatres and they need to send it to their fucking people and go, vote for us, vote for us.
Okay, well, they did do that and it was the last weekend in November that year.
Okay, so what does it make in the States? I wonder how big it's opening. Firth, I think they know Firth over in the States. They love the Royals.
They love Bridget Jones's Diary.
They love English people. I think this is going to be marketed up the yin yang. So let's say it makes 4 million.
Well, sir, you are wrong.
Ugh, I mean, I would be, because it's like... It's either
it was $355,000.
Okay. That makes sense.
Makes sense?
Yeah. I'm happy to take that. I'll wear that.
Sure. I mean, it's not a choice. It's just on your bodice. But anyway, now, gross worldwide. Here's where it gets... interesting.
Do you know, to interrupt, do you know US and Canada total?
I do, yeah.
I think it'd be fun to know how much you make, because the States, their relationship to the Royals, I think it could be, and given the Oscars, I think that, like, it could be a fun guess.
Yeah. I do like it. I tell you what we should do is we do gross worldwide first, yeah, and then we'll do this like we did last week with Crouching Tiger. Let's do it as a proportion of, yeah?
Proportion of. Yeah, I don't know proportion, yeah. I'll just say what it was. Sure, okay, sure. Gross worldwide. Gross worldwide. Crouching Tiger, as I recall, I think it made like 200 or something, or 300.
It made just over 200.
Don't tell me.
You just said it.
Yeah, but like that's me going into my memory palace, pulling off a book off my memory palace shelf and kind of going, meh. If you tell me this is me showing my working, I'm Darren Brown. If you then tell me it, the audience is like, well, Joe's just told him.
It's like, if you're about to do the 10X, which I don't think you were, you'd be guessing $3.5 million.
Yeah, of
course. I'm just curious, like, how far.
No,
I'm just wondering what you think the multiplier might be.
Crouching Tiger, mate. I'm comparing it to Crouching Tiger.
Sure.
That's not nothing to do with. Not nothing to do with.
Sure.
So don't tell me.
No.
You're embarrassed. You're embarrassed because you fucked yourself and you've fucked me. And now
I think you're embarrassed because you guessed opening weekend so badly and the audience were laughing at you.
Okay. I think this did boffo.
I mean, that sounds three Bs.
Yeah, I think it made $300 million.
Well, sir, you're obviously wrong. Do you want to guess, was it a less or was it a more?
No, just tell me. I don't know.
Come on, one more little guess. Come on. A less or a more?
Less.
Wrong again. The movie... you'll be delighted to hear. Plucky little Colin Firth. This film took $472 million gross.
Right, worldwide. Listen, like, fuck you for making that like lesser or more. I said 300 and it made near 500. I'm nowhere near 10% rule, but I'm in the fucking ballpark.
Are you
you absolute scumbag. Fucking hell, should we play the game?
Yes, please. Hit me.
This is the bit of the show where one of us reads out a list of movies they forgot, or the other person, or they think that the other person forgot they forgot, to get them on a movie to decide what flick we'll chat about. And if I don't get you in five, where do we go?
The communal list.
The communal list.
Which definitely exists.
Well, I'm not confident about this week.
Right. Oh, really?
It's, I'm just going to say the thing. I'm going to say, I haven't thought about this. I haven't told you. I don't want, you know, sometimes we chat about things off mic. I haven't chatted about any of this idea with you.
Oh.
So here we go.
Okay.
I'm going to say films that I want to do and I want to get you on. And if I don't get you on them...
It's communal list time.
You're going to take me to the list.
All right, fine. I accept the challenge.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the summary of the game. That's just like every normal week, except for some reason the stakes feel higher.
It's called storytelling, yeah. My friend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you'd read as many script writing books as I had,
I would know what it is called.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's not. Okay, here we go. Godzilla 2014, the one starring Bryan Cranston and Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Never watched it, mate. If you'd said Godzilla 1999, starring Sarah Jessica Parker's husband and a John Frank French Leon, then maybe I would have said, oh, could be.
No.
But no, I never saw 2014 Godzilla.
I never saw 1999 Godzilla because I'm
not
a loser. It was...
What, because you don't like Matthew Broderick and the woman who looks like...
Matthew Broderick.
What, you don't like Matthew Broderick and the woman that looks like Kirsten Dunst but isn't?
I was coming into my own watching cinema at that time and I'm not... You know,
1999 was too big a year for you to.
I know that that's going to be a stinker, and it was. Okay.
Do you know anything about that film?
Oh yeah, I know that it's shit.
Okay, but do you know that the whole sort of third act of that film, when you think they've got Godzilla already or whatever, is that the whole of what's that massive stadium in New York that they're always talking about, Madison Square Garden? The whole of Madison Square Garden is filled with Godzilla eggs.
Eggs.
And they're all hatching, and it's a bit like the Velociraptor scene in Jurassic Park, and it's really stupid.
They've realised the problem with all Godzilla movies is that they can't afford a big giant monster.
Yeah.
And also,
sure,
it's hard to make that immediate, and so they've gone tiny, tiny Godzillas.
Well, they did have a big giant monster for a long time in that film, to give it its credit. I thought you were going to say they've realised the problem with Godzilla is that Godzilla can't procreate because Godzilla's just one.
No.
You know?
Kong Island. No, Kong.
Skull Island.
Skull Island.
With Jack Black and Adrian Brody.
Oh my God, every fucking time.
Oh, Tom Hiddleston.
Jesus H. Jack Black and Adrian Brody were in King Kong.
Right.
The King
Skull
Kong
Island.
Remake.
Yeah. Oh, Brie Larson.
Brie Larson,
no,
Tom Hiddleston.
No, and that's actually an atrocious film. It's also got John C. Reilly in it, right?
I don't think it is an atrocious film. I think it is canon Forgot You Forgot. It's really rewatchable. I did see that the runtime is 2 hours 20.
Forgot it, son, and I'm not watching it again. I've watched it twice, and it's not good enough for me to want to watch it a third time. The John C. Reilly thing is funny, but it doesn't work, and I don't care about it.
Yeah, you've...
I think I've knocked you back on that before.
You have.
Yeah.
You have.
Uh-huh.
And it's my right.
Right. Sure.
Because you're a leaky bucket boy.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
You're a leaky bucket boy, mate.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
You have remembered that I have suggested that before.
Yeah.
Which suggests your bucket is actually got fewer holes.
Sure.
Than I like to
I think it
pretend.
Just, it retains certain things that I really don't want to watch. And that's one
okay,
of them.
Okay. 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 I'm going to go for this. The Lobster.
Oh.
That sounds like an oh. Oh, I forgot. And oh, I don't want to.
The thing is, right?
Oh, what's the thing?
Here's the thing. Yorgos Lanthimos. Yeah?
Yeah.
I loved Poor Things. We talked about that, I think. I really enjoyed Poor Things. You didn't like it. I
hated that.
I have only seen The Lobster once in the cinema. I distinctly remember being in the Greenwich Picture House and thinking it was all couples and me. And the couples were all laughing at the jokes about couples and single people. And I remember thinking, fuck everyone in here. You know, I had to sit next to someone. It was so busy. Everyone wanted to see that film at the Greenwich Picture House, you know. You know it's a bad film when a picture house is sold out. Because the kind of people that go to picture houses... also want to see films that no one else should want to see. And when it's sold out, it's a sort of convalescence of just, a horror show. Anyway.
I don't think you mean the word convalescence. That's when you're really ill and you had a convalescence when you had your bum seen to. Yeah?
What do I mean? What is it? A conjugal visit? It's a conjugal visit listen, I'm going to play that card where I say I can't really remember the film.
Yeah.
I haven't forgotten it because it's not a forgot you forgot. It isn't canon forgot, right? It's still, maybe in another 5 years it will be, but it's not right now.
It's canon you forgot
we
you forgot.
We could do it, but it's no. It's nowhere near Plum. It might just qualify, but I want to hear the other two first. I think we can agree we don't need to go to the communal list, but I do want to hear the other two before I decide whether to give you lobster or not.
Give me lobster. Yeah. That sounds really... Oh, give me lobster,
to give you
baby.
A lob on or not.
I'm going to keep swinging for the fucking...
Yeah, swing.
The swing,
hit those
swing,
fences,
swing,
man. I want to hear that chain link go bang.
Because there are some I know, mm-hmm. and the audience, those who know, and they would catch me out.
Sure.
If I said something.
Yeah. A chain link can't go bang. Clang.
Hannibal.
I've never seen it.
Jesus H. That would have ticked up for Ridley Scott. That would have done a
You could have got me on you know.
Don't say Silence of the Lambs.
Silence of the Lambs, because I've only seen it don't once. Because I've only seen it once a long time ago. But
no, don't say that.
No, sure.
Okay. Fifth.
Let me say, listen, just before, I want to raise the stakes a little bit here, okay? There's a potential 10% got on the lobster. It's low grade, okay? You've never gone through this many films before without me feeling more than tiny partial Plum. I want to feel socked by you, okay? So look at the fifth film you've got. Tell me in your heart of hearts if you think it's going to Plum me or not. And if it's not, dig out a Plum, okay? The stakes are high, Adam. I do not want to watch The Lobster.
Okay, here we go. 500 Days of Summer.
No. Hate that fucking film so much.